Okay, got it. Armed with both our matrix and the reliable analysis of our friends, we knew what to expect. Lots and lots of negative stories about George W. Bush, and lots of positive ones about Albert Gore. So you can understand why we were stunned when we saw an actual study on media coverage during the 2000 election. What actually happened during the 2000 election campaign blows to smithereens the predictions of our hypothetical liberal media paradigm matrix. Get a load of these figures from the Pew Charitable Trust's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Tone of coverage for Gore and Bush. Positive. Gore, 13%. Bush, 24%. Neutral. Gore, 31%. Bush, 27%. Negative. Gore, 56%. Bush, 49%. Holy shit, this makes no sense. The numbers for Gore, the liberal, were more negative and a lot less positive than the numbers for Bush. The media, which we just assumed to be liberal because that's what we had heard so often, was actually nicer to the conservative. Could that possibly be true? Let's look at that again. Tone of coverage for Gore and Bush. Positive. Gore, 13%. Bush, 24%. Neutral. Gore, 31%. Bush, 27%. Negative. Gore, 56%. Bush, 49%. Holy shit. A million questions race through our minds. Who are these Pew people? Where do these numbers come from? Was this just another liberal lie? No. It turns out that the Pew Charitable Trusts are among the largest, most prestigious foundations in America. Totally mainstream. Their Project for Excellence in Journalism comes out of the top-rated Columbia School of Journalism and is one of the few media research organizations without a political axe to grind. And the numbers? Turns out they came from a comprehensive study examining 1,149 stories from 17 leading news sources. What could this possibly mean? Either there was something terribly wrong with our HLMP matrix, or there is something terribly wrong with Ann, Sean, and Bernard. So what had happened? Well, it turns out that Team Franken had spent the 2000 election cycle locked away in its ivory tower. Any normal American who watched the news or read the papers that year would have noticed that the media just hated Al Gore. Somewhere along the line, the PAC decided that Al Gore was a sanctimonious, graspy exaggerator running against a likable, if dim-witted, goof-off. Instead of covering the issues and how they might affect average Americans, the media looked for little scraps of evidence to support its storyline of Gore the exaggerator. They found them in the unlikeliest places, for example, where he didn't exaggerate. Take his role in the creation of the Internet. In the 1980s, Gore was one of a handful of leaders who foresaw the tremendous potential of ARPANET, an emergency military computer network. As both a congressman and a senator, Gore fought tirelessly for the funding that would turn the ARPANET into what is now the Internet. The Internet, as you may know, became a big hit in the 90s and briefly enjoyed a great deal of media coverage. With this in mind, Gore told Wolf Blitzer in a 1999 interview, quote, "During my service in the United States Congress, I took the initiative in creating the Internet." What do you suppose he meant? That late at night in his office in the Russell Building, after the other senators had gone home, he had written the Pascal code that allowed packet switching? Probably not. No, what he seemed to be doing is what members of Congress do. He was taking credit for a program he championed and funded, in this case one that revolutionized the information infrastructure of the entire world. What an asshole. The phrase "invented the Internet" first appeared in a Republican Party press release and would be repeated by the liberal press thousands of times during the campaign. What should have been an enormous credit to the man's vision became a symbol of his insidious compulsive dishonesty. Ironically, Gore was sometimes criticized via the Internet itself. When a few people like me pointed out that he hadn't actually said that he invented the Internet, Ann Coulter responded, quote, "In point of fact, create is a synonym for invent. Any thesaurus will quickly confirm this," unquote. Well, that may be true, but the very same thesaurus would show that friendly is a synonym for intimate. So when Anne told the New York Observer that she and I were friendly, they knew it was her way of claiming that we are lovers, which we most certainly are not. I am not currently having an affair with any Republican woman, but if I were, it would be with Maine Senator Olympia Snowe, whom I respect for voting her conscience. Speaking of intimacy, let's get back to how Gore was buggered by his enemies in the media. Take the love story, which is really more of a hate story or a false story. Read on, friend, for the true story of the false, hateful love story. In 1997, Gore was on Air Force Two chatting late into the night with a couple of reporters, including Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine. The conversation turned, as conversations will, to movies and reminiscing about old friends. Gore mentioned that Eric Segal, the author of Love Story, had told the Nashville Tennessean that the characters of Oliver Barrett and Jenny Cavallari had been based on him and Tipper. As Tumulty later recalled, quote, he said, "All I know is that's what he, Segal, told reporters in Tennessee." She casually referred to this in her 7-page profile as follows, quote, "Gore said Segal used Alan Tipper as models for the uptight preppy and his free-spirited girlfriend in Love Story." Was Gore lying? Imagine how embarrassing it would be if he were. Just thinking about it makes me embarrassed, not just for him, but for every vice president other than Spiro Agnew and, to a lesser extent, Dan Quayle. Thank goodness, then, that in 1980, the Nashville Tennessean had indeed quoted Segal as saying that Tipper and Al had been the models for the star-crossed lovers. Phew. But here's where it all starts to go terribly, terribly wrong. It turns out the Tennessean had misquoted Eric Segal. And when the New York Times contacted him, Segal confirmed that Oliver Barrett was based partly on Gore and partly on Gore's roommate Tommy Lee Jones, and I like to think a tiny bit on me. But he denied that Tipper was the model for poor Jenny Cavallari. As anyone who has seen the movie knows, that character was based on Ally McGraw. The media went to town. An offhand remark, accurately quoting a 17-year-old story from his local paper, would be used against Gore more than a billion times over the next 3 years. Here's an excerpt from the September 19th, 2000 Hannity and Combs program. Hannity is talking to talk show host Nancy Skinner. Hannity: "This is a big picture we've got to look at. Al Gore once told the American people, told the crowd, Love Story was based on his life and Tipper's life. The author of Love Story says that's not true."
"No, that's not true, Sean."
"Absolutely, he's on record. Did he create the internet, Nancy?"
"No, we're starting with Love Story. Okay, Eric Segal said that indeed Al was the model for the male model."
"That's not true."
"But that he never said Tipper was, and that all Al Gore had ever said..."
"Not true."
"...is that he had read in the Tennessean, a newspaper, that where Eric Segal had said that he and Tipper were the model. You know what? The Tennessean newspaper did write that. Eric Segal has confirmed that it was Al Gore, but not necessarily Tipper. So there was a minor difference that got blown
into..." "I don't have a lot of time to refute every fact here." "Refute every fact? Sean, some of us are more concerned about refuting lies." So, Gore takes credit for a program he championed and funded, and then he accurately quotes from a newspaper. Noticing a pattern here? An insidious, compulsive pattern? It gets worse. In January of 2000, Gore spoke to a high school in Concord, New Hampshire, about how one individual can help change a community. He told a story about how the actions of one teenage girl from Toone, Tennessee, changed national policy. The girl had contacted Gore's congressional office about toxic waste in her hometown. Because of her initiative, Gore said, he, quote, called for a congressional investigation and a hearing. "I looked around the country for other sites like that. I found a little place in upstate New York called Love Canal. Had the first hearing on that issue, and Toone, Tennessee, that was the one you didn't hear of, but that was the one that started it all." Gore pointed out that as a result, quote, "we passed a major national law to clean up hazardous dump sites, and it all happened because one high school student got involved." In other words, Gore told his audience of high school students that they should put aside their cynicism and get involved in the political process. Gore had a sterling reputation as an environmental crusader, but here he was handing credit over to an unheralded teenage girl from a little town called Toon. His speech was a beacon of hope for decency and humility in American politics. A careful observer would have noted Gore's hands firmly gripping the podium, his ass extended behind him, awaiting the brutal violation the media was about to administer. First, both the New York Times and the Washington Post misquoted Gore, changing, "That was the one that started it all," referring to Toon, Tennessee, and making it into, "I was the one that started it all." The Republican National Committee helpfully fixed up the grammar, sending a fax to reporters stating that Gore had said, quote, "I was the one who started it all." Chris Matthews joined in the gangbang, accusing Gore of claiming to have, quote, "discovered" or even, quote, "invented" Love Canal. Even though the New York Times and the Washington Post issued corrections, the story was off and running. Rupert Murdoch, in the form of the New York Post, called it a bald-faced lie. The National Journal said Gore was, quote, "mangling the truth for political gain." On NBC, ABC, pretty much everywhere, Gore the exaggerator had done it again. I mean, was the man sick? Yes, he had held the first hearing on Love Canal, and yes, those hearings had led to a major national law superfund, and yes, he had told the story accurately. But come on, Al, how many times do you have to be misquoted before you learn not to ever say anything to anyone that could possibly be taken out of context and changed to make you look bad? Like Oliver Barrett IV, Al Gore was learning the painful truth that being a reporter means never having to say you're sorry. Meanwhile, over in the Bush camp, things weren't too rosy either. Anytime the candidate said something stupid, it was jumped on as evidence that he might not be up to the job. Sometimes the criticism seemed fair, like when he said that, quote, "more and more of our imports are coming from overseas." And when he said, quote, "I know how hard it is for you to put food on your family." Or when he said, "I will have a foreign-handed foreign policy." Or when he said, "I know the human being and the fish can coexist peacefully." Or when he said, "families is where our nation finds hope, where our wings take dream." Stupid, stupid, stupid. But sometimes Bush, too, was a victim of a cynical, hypercritical press. Like when he was ridiculed for saying, "rarely is the question asked, is our children learning?" But he was right. Until Bush had had the guts to ask it, I had never heard that question asked. Or how about when he used the word subliminable? Not once, but four times. Personally, I think by using the word subliminable, Bush was himself employing a subtle subliminal device. Think about it. Subliminable. 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 Subliminally, I am able to be president. See? It took until this very moment for you to get it, didn't it? But while the press may not have been picking up on his clever strategy of lowering expectations and subliminally manipulating the public, they were also ignoring some actual substantive lies. Bush was lying throughout the 2000 campaign, and unlike Gore's lies about Love Canal, Love Story, and the Internet, Bush's lies weren't even true. Remember how Gore took credit for the Internet, which he funded? Bush took credit for a Texas patient's Bill of Rights, which he vetoed. Gore actually did conduct the first hearings on Love Canal, and in order to conduct these hearings, he not only showed up at them, but showed up at them every day. Plus, Gore wasn't using the hearings as a way to dodge the draft. Compare this to Bush's stint in the Air National Guard. In his autobiography, A Charge to Keep, Bush claims to have flown with his unit until 1973. But in a blow to Lady Truth, it seems that after getting Dad's help to pass over the poor slobs waiting in line for a safe spot protecting Texas from the Viet Cong, Bush managed to skip out on much of his duty. Assigned in May 1972 to the Tactical Reconnaissance Squadron in Montgomery, Bush had a perfect attendance record. Perfectly bad. Base Commander Brigadier General William Turnipseed says of Bush that he is, quote, "dead certain he didn't show up." Regarding Love Story, at no time during that controversy did Gore ever get arrested for drunk driving. The contrast to Bush's 1976 arrest for drunk driving couldn't be more stark. More damaging still is the bold-faced lie Bush told reporter Wayne Slater of the Dallas Morning News months before the drunk driving arrest had been disclosed. According to Slater, their conversation went like this. I think you'll agree it's unambiguous. Slater, Governor, were you ever arrested after 1968? Bush, no. The drunk driving thing uncaged a whole zoo full of lying. Here's a good one from Bush spokeswoman Karen Hughes, fielding reporters' questions minutes after the announcement of Bush's unfortunate past as a drunk driver. Question. Do you know why he was stopped, Karen? Was he driving erratically or anything? Karen Hughes. There was some discussion that he appeared to have been driving too slowly. The real answer? Bush was arrested because he drove into a hedge. That's what the arresting officer, Calvin Bridges, a former Kennebunkport policeman, told Portland, Maine's Fox 51 reporter Aaron Failau the day the story broke. According to Failau, Bridges said that, quote, he spotted Bush driving erratically and says Bush ran off the road into some hedges. Let's try to get into Karen's head, shall we? First off, it's pretty apparent that she didn't know. I derive that from the I don't know exactly, no, I don't know, and the I don't know exactly. Why did she say this three times? I think she was stalling while her savvy political mind weighed the implications. Drunk driving. Bad. What's wrong with drunk driving? Kill people. People dead. Very, very bad. What would be the least deadly way to drive drunk? Erratically? No. Too fast? No. Too slow? Yes. Too slow. That's it. There was some discussion that he appeared to have been driving too slow, too slowly. Yeah, that's good. The media dutifully picked up on this, even following her line of reasoning. As a columnist in the Washington Times wrote, quote, as for Mr. Bush, it may be revealing that he was not speeding like so many people driving under the influence of alcohol, but was in fact pulled over by the police because he was driving too slowly. Great job, Karen. There's the cocaine. The week after the release of Radiation at Three Mile Island, I wrote a Saturday Night Live sketch with Tom Davis and Jim Downey called The Amazing Colossal President. In it, President Carter visits a nuclear power plant during an event, is irradiated, and grows to enormous size. At a press conference, a reporter asks a spokesman for the nuclear plant, is it true the president is over 100 feet tall? No, absolutely not. That is untrue, the spokesman says indignantly. Is it true the president is over 90 feet tall, asks another reporter. No comment. You didn't have to be a genius to know that the amazing colossal president was somewhere between 90 and 100 feet tall. In the same way, it didn't take a genius to figure out that George W. Bush snorted cocaine sometime before 1974. At first during the campaign, Bush refused on principle to answer questions about cocaine. Then, because he was applying for a federal job president, he had to fill out a form that asked if he had used illegal drugs in the past 7 years. Bush voluntarily told the press he was able to answer no. A clever reporter asked whether he could have given the same answer when his father was president, and federal forms asked about drug use for the prior 15 years. Let's see here. Yes, I could have, Bush said after a pause. Then when asked again if he had ever used cocaine, Bush refused to give an answer. His dad was inaugurated in 1989. Therefore, using the amazing colossal president test, George W. Bush snorted cocaine between 1958 and 1974, assuming he didn't do coke before he was 12. So, we've got the patient's bill of rights you vetoed, the draft dodging, the drunk driving, and the cocaine. What about serious stuff, like how he got rich, like the Harkin business, when, as a member of the audit committee, he dumped his stock just before it was about to tank and was 8 months late in filing documents with the Securities and Exchange Commission? like his ridiculously underanalyzed tax plan. If this is getting too confusing, let me just summarize the raw material the media could have used to go negative against the candidates. Gore supposedly claimed to have discovered a canal. Bush skirted securities law by selling Harkin Energy stocks while sitting on the audit committee, lied about having supported the Texas Patients Bill of Rights and hate crime bill. Gore. All I know is that's what he told reporters in Tennessee. Bush. By far, the vast majority of my tax cut goes to those at the bottom end of the spectrum. Gore. Funded the internet, which changed history forever. Bush. Snorted cocaine, dodged the draft, drove drunk into a hedge. In other words, both candidates made serious mistakes and legitimate questions could have been raised about their fitness for national office. Why, then, did Bush get twice as many positive stories and so many fewer negative stories? Hummus. That's right. Remember the oil in the hummus? It's the other biases that killed Gore. Pack mentality. Once the pack had decided the storyline on Gore, everybody jumped aboard and rode it all the way to November. Also, laziness. That's a big bias. Why bother to check facts when you can quote yesterday's story about a story that ran the day before yesterday? Negativity. What's more likely to hit the front page? Gore tells inspirational story to high schoolers or Gore lies again? Plus, Bush was a news story. Gore was old. And the media just didn't like Gore. And by attacking him, reporters were safe from the accusation of having a liberal bias, or were they? Writing in the Charleston Gazette, Dan Rademacher cited a study by Howard Kurtz that found almost twice as many pro-Bush stories as pro-Gore stories on the front page of the New York Times during the campaign. An incredulous Ann Coulter could find only one explanation for a liberal newspaper implying a conservative bias in the Times. Quote, the sheer joy liberals take in telling lies. They take insolent pleasure in saying absurd things. I called Rademacher at his Charleston, West Virginia office. Team Franken transcribed the conversation. Al. Hi, Dan. It's Al Franken. Did you know that Ann Coulter referred to one of your columns in her book? Dan Rademacher. Really? Al. It was the one where you cited Howard Kurtz's study on media coverage during the election? Dan. Oh, God. What did she say? Al. That's exactly why I'm calling. She said that your column shows that liberals take sheer joy in telling lies. So I wanted to ask you, do you take sheer joy in telling lies? Dan, yes, I do. Al, shoot. That proves her point then. Also, she mentions insolent pleasure. Do you get insolent pleasure from lying? Dan, yeah, I guess so. But it's more sheer joy. Al, so more sheer joy than insolent pleasure. Dan, yeah, that's about right. By the way, we have a bet here in the newsroom about what exactly is wrong with Ann Coulter. Al, I can't help you out. I don't claim to understand it. Anyway, thanks, Dan. Dan, sure, Al. That's one of the nice things about this job. Making contact with fellow liberals and taking insolent pleasure and or experiencing the joy of lying to you, our listeners. I'd made a friend for life. Chapter 8. Conclusion. A Lesson Learned. As the application of Team Franken's hypothetical liberal media bias paradigm matrix amply demonstrates, there is no liberal bias in the media when it comes to politics. What a pity. I think a little liberal bias would make me feel better about all three branches of the government being controlled by the right. Let's review. Politics. No liberal bias. Social issues. Trivial liberal bias. No mainstream journalist has ever bombed an abortion clinic. Sports. Massive but inconsequential conservative bias. See Marv Albert's excellent book, Curveball. An insider shows how sportscasters put a rightward spin on the games you love. The funnies. Funny bias. Or, in the case of Family Circus, funny and heartwarming bias. Am I overlooking anything important? I guess I'm done. That was easy, my second shortest book ever. I guess I'll just check my stock portfolio. Money is so important to me. Wait, that's it. Money, that's what I was forgetting. Economic issues. Nuts, I'm not finished at all. Now I wish I hadn't dismissed Team Franken. Well, I'll just have to get them back and assign them to do a massive amount of research on how the media covers economic issues while I figure out some way to make that interesting. Wait, I've got an idea. Chapter 9. 5 Get-Rich-Quick Tips The Wall Street Fat Cats Don't Want You to Know. Tip number 1. Never option stock in a blue chip where the market cap is 20 times the I made this all up. Economic issues can seem dry and technical for the average person. In fact, there is only one type of economic story that has proven to be universally captivating year after year. I am speaking, of course, of stories about lottery winners, where they bought their winning ticket, where they were when they heard they had won, whether they planned to keep their job, and what kind of car they planned to buy. But I'll admit, the stories about the unemployment rate, our national debt, and the balance of trade can seem a bit dry compared to a lottery winner. But look at it this way. A story about the unemployment rate is a story about whether you have a job. A story about the national debt is a story about whether or not you can afford the interest payments on your house. And that story about the balance of trade? Okay, that's a little dry. So, economic issues are just as important as stories about politics, social issues, and Whitney Houston. And the fact is, the mainstream media has a bona fide conservative bias when it comes to economic issues. Don't take my word for it, because I sometimes include jokes in the things I write. My credibility can be suspect compared to someone without a sense of humor like Bernie Goldberg. Check out this 1998 study on the economic views of Washington journalists conducted by Dr. David Croteau of Virginia Commonwealth University. The survey found that while journalists consider themselves slightly to the left on social issues, they don't think they're liberal on economic issues. In fact, almost twice as many say they're to the right on economic issues as say they're to the left. And when it comes to Social Security, Medicare, free trade, corporate power, taxes, and health care, the study shows that journalists are significantly to the right of the general public. Charts bore me, at least regular charts bore me. That's why I've decided to pep this one up with a little gentle humor. Issue: reforming Social Security by slowing spending should be one of our top few priorities. Journalists, 56%. Public, 35%. My comment: see how journalists differ from the public? Issue: protecting Social Security and Medicare should be one of our top few priorities. Journalists, 39%. Public, 59%. Might it be relevant that half of all journalists make six-figure salaries? Issue: too much power is in the hands of a few corporations. Journalists, 24% strongly agree. Public, 62% strongly agree. Maybe if more of the public worked for those corporations, they'd like them too. Issue: agree that the government should guarantee medical coverage for those without health insurance. Journalists, 43%. The public, 64%. Wait, that adds up to more than 100%. That's impossible. Oh, I see. Never mind. Issue: did NAFTA have more of a positive or more of a negative impact on the United States? Journalists, 65% positive. The public, 32% positive. Twice as many journalists like NAFTA. I'll bet you love the funny way I explore this one below. So, journalists are economically conservative, but this makes sense given their position in society. Journalists have it made. Their lives are trouble-free. If you've ever met a journalist, you'll know what I mean. They're the happiest people on God's earth. But put their contentment and good cheer to the side for a moment and consider, why is it that journalists are only one-fifth as likely as the general public to have a negative view of NAFTA? And why does every major news outlet line up in favor of every opportunity to expand free trade? It's simple, actually. Here's how free trade works. Tariffs on imports go down, and along with them go prices on products that journalists buy, like those fedoras you always see in movies. That's the upside. The downside of free trade is that low-skilled fedora-making jobs get exported overseas. So, lower prices for consumers, but job insecurity for those with low skills. Journalists are pro-free trade precisely because they know that their jobs are not at risk for exportation. That's the same reason why I've always been pro-NAFTA, pro-GATT, and pro-fast-track authority. I know that a 14-year-old Bangladeshi might be able to sew my sneakers, but there's no way he could write this book. Or so I thought. When I was explaining the idea for this chapter to my editor, Mitch, it gave him an idea. Why not save a few bucks and have a 14-year-old Bangladeshi boy write the book? Fortunately for me, his first attempt proved my point. Try as he might, Karup Jutta could not capture my hip, sophisticated New York sensibility. But judge for yourself.
Chapter 10. Chapter for American Book by Karup Jutta. My job in the factory is very hard. I made stitch shoes for many hours. It is hard for me to stitch, but the men do not care. Yesterday, I punctured my finger on the machine. I tried to squeeze it, but the bleeding would not stop. When I asked the men to let me go see the nurse at the mission hospital, they hit me with insoles. My 12-year-old sister, Choto, began to yell at the men. I told her to be quiet and return to her work. The men told me that if she causes trouble again, they will fire her, and she will have to become a prostitute. I am dizzy with hunger.
Chapter 11. I'm funnier than Karup Jutta. See, that isn't funny. Karup's no threat to me. In professional comedy, the technical term for writers like Karup Jutta is talentless hack. Karup, a word of advice from a guy who's been in the business twice as long as you've been alive. As long as you're going for the easy laugh with your Choto gag, the word is hooker. Never use prostitute when you can use hooker. Unless you're doing a corporate gig, in which case the phrase is world's oldest profession. What I'm trying to get at here is, keep your day job, kid. Or in your case, your day and night job. There, I've put the kid in his place. The fact is, free trade may not be good for everybody. It may not be good for you, my listener, or for the Karup Jutas of this world, of which there are 3 or 4 billion. But it is good for people in the entertainment industry. People like me, Haley Joel Osment, and Bill O'Reilly. Chapter 12. The chapter on Fox. They distort, we deride. Or, we retort, they have lied. Or, they purport, we decry. Or, smarty smart, blort de blort. Now that Team Franken has proven there's no liberal bias in the mainstream media, we can move on to the right-wing media. I should start by telling you that when I first proposed this book, my publisher turned me down flat. The year was 1986, and at that point, just about all the right-wing media was in print. The Wall Street Journal editorial page, the Washington Times, the National Review, etc. My publisher made the point that even the thousands of people who read books got most of their news from television. My book on the lies of the right-wing media would have to wait until there was a whole network devoted to right-wing lies. The Fox News Channel was launched by Rupert Murdoch on October 6, 1996, with Roger Ailes at its helm. Both Murdoch and Ailes are colorful men. In Murdoch's case, the color is green, or magenta, the color of the Australian $5 bill. He has over 2 billion of these. Forbes magazine ranks him the fourth most powerful billionaire in the world. If you'll assume with me that billionaires are billions of times more powerful than normal people, you can see that the Forbes ranking means a lot. In addition to the Fox News Channel, Murdoch's News Corporation owns TV Guide. You know how many people read TV Guide? Neither do I, but it must be millions. He also owns 24 other magazines, including the Weekly Standard, the neoconservative periodical that tricked President Bush into going to war against Iraq. He also owns the Fox Broadcasting Network, which produced Joe Millionaire, a hit show, and HarperCollins Publishing. Think about all those put together. Quite an empire, right? But wait! He also owns 20th Century Fox, which owns the rights to over 2,000 movies, including Dr. Doolittle, and Dr. Doolittle too. Dr. Doolittle too didn't do as well as Dr. Doolittle, but Fox owns Titanic, which was a huge hit. Plus, he has ownership or major interests in satellite services reaching Asia, Europe, North America, and South America. That's practically the entire world, excluding the emerging African market. I would think that anyone would be satisfied with that much media. I know I would. Heck, I'd be happy with just TV Guide, HarperCollins, Fox Broadcasting, and the satellite companies. But even all this stuff doesn't satisfy K. Rupert Murdoch. No, he has to own the largest group of television stations in the United States, plus 130 English-language newspapers, including the London Times and the New York Post. You might notice that many of these holdings have, shall we say, a rightward cant. So you won't be surprised when I tell you that the cherry on top of Murdoch's corporate empire is the Los Angeles Dodgers, the most notoriously right-wing team in the history of Major League Baseball. Plus, he owns the Fox News Channel, which brings us full circle. But before I go into FNC, there's another important thing you should know about Murdoch. He's evil. I defer to the August Columbia Journalism Review. Murdoch uses his diverse holdings to promote his own financial interests at the expense of real news gathering, legal and regulatory rules, and journalistic ethics. He wields his media as instruments of influence with politicians who can aid him, and savages his competitors in his news columns. If ever someone demonstrated the dangers of mass power being concentrated in few hands, it would be Murdoch. But evil? How about a specific example, Al? Okay. In 1993, Murdoch, a staunch anti-communist, began beaming programs into China from his Hong Kong-based Star TV satellite network. At the time, Murdoch expressed a noble sentiment that, quote, "advances in the technology of telecommunications have proved an unambiguous threat to totalitarian regimes everywhere." Angered by Murdoch's apparent lack of support for their totalitarian regime, China retaliated by banning the ownership of satellite dishes. Murdoch knew which side his rice was buttered on and switched to a more, shall we say, pro-totalitarian point of view. Quote, "The truth is, and we Americans don't like to admit it, that authoritarian societies can work," he told critics. And to show the Central Committee that he had just been kidding about that unambiguous threat business, he cheerfully removed the BBC from his Star network. The BBC, it seems, had covered the Tiananmen Square unpleasantness and, according to Murdoch, was, quote, "driving them," the totalitarian Chinese regime, "nuts." So, goodbye BBC, hello satellite dishes in the world's largest potential media market. But some good came of this whole thing. Murdoch launched a multi-million-dollar joint venture with the People's Daily, the official state newspaper. The venture produced China Byte, an online news service that helped bring official Chinese government propaganda into the digital age. Now, please understand that I'm not saying Rupert has a pro-communist bias, just a pro-getting money and power no matter who gets hurt bias. Most of the time, this bias makes him indistinguishable from someone with a straight-up right-wing bias. He has been a tireless supporter of conservative politicians from Margaret Thatcher to Newt Gingrich, who've returned his favors with tax breaks and shady deregulations. But as you can see from his self-serving support of a murderous, godless communist regime, Murdoch's bottom line is less about politics and more about the bottom line. Roger Ailes, however, is someone you can always rely on to stick to his conservative Republican guns. There is absolutely no question about this guy. He is a rock-ribbed, dyed-in-the-wool Republican through and through. Want a guy who will bash Democrats with everything he's got? You want Roger Ailes. That's why when Rupert Murdoch needed help starting a conservative cable news channel, he knew the right man for the job. The man who had been the GOP's preeminent political consultant. The man who had helped elect Nixon, Reagan, and George H.W. Bush. The man who's been called the Dark Prince of right-wing attack politics. It was Ailes, along with his dark co-prince Lee Atwater, who directed the Willie Horton attack against Michael Dukakis. And it was Ailes who said, quote, "the only question is whether we depict Willie Horton with a knife in his hand or without it." It was Ailes who produced Rush Limbaugh's ill-fated TV show. And it was Roger Ailes who was the right choice for Murdoch's right-wing channel. Al would run the network, set its right-wing tone, guide its right-wing programming, choose its right-wing stars, and, most importantly, pick its slogan, Fair and Balanced. And its tagline, We Report, You Decide. Tucker Carlson, the conservative co-host of CNN's Crossfire, has explained that the reason the Fox News Channel calls itself Fair and Balanced is to, quote, drive liberals crazy. There are others who suggest that Ailes really believes that FNC is fair and balanced, but only looks right-wing because the rest of the media is so far to the left. This would be a plausible argument if the rest of the media actually had a liberal bias, or if Fox wasn't so obviously slanted to the right, or if Ailes weren't a cynical Republican ideologue with no regard for fairness or balance, any of those would add a lot to that argument. When Murdoch installed him at Fox, one of Ailes' first acts of balance was to clean house. Joe Peronin, then president of Fox News, told me the story. I had about 40 people working for me, Joe told me, and he asked some of them if they were liberal or not. There was a litmus test. He was going to figure out who was liberal or conservative when he came in and try to get rid of the liberals. Did Joe think this was appropriate? I told him I didn't think it was appropriate. Did Joe stay at the job? I resigned. So disgusted was Joe that he left English language journalism altogether and is now executive vice president of news and information programming at Telemundo. Adios, Joe. Adios, fairness. Hola, Señor Ailes. House clean. Ailes went to work hiring his team. For managing editor, he chose veteran journalist Britt Hume, a contributor to the ultra-conservative Weekly Standard and the ultra-ultra-conservative American Spectator. For Washington bureau chief, Ailes chose Britt's wife, Kim, who was determined to change the tone of television journalism. Mainstream stories, she complained in 1997, are, quote, all mushy like AIDS or all silly like Head Start. Hubby also anchors the nightly news show Special Report with Britt Hume, which concludes with Britt moderating a three-person panel of pundits. The most frequent panelist is prominent conservative Fred Barnes, editor of the Weekly Standard. Most often with Barnes are Moore Kondracki, centrist editor of Roll Call, a fiercely nonpartisan newspaper that reports on Capitol Hill, and Mara Liasson, a reporter for National Public Radio who's been both a registered Democrat and registered Republican. In case you're counting, that's two hardcore conservatives and two centrists. Imagine a political game of seesaw with two people sitting on one end and two others sitting in the middle. See how balance works on Special Report with Britt Hume? Fox's contribution to the Sunday morning political shows is Fox News Sunday with Tony Snow. Snow, a former speechwriter for the first President Bush, was editorial page editor for the Washington Times and is a frequent substitute host for the Rush Limbaugh radio show, which itself has been accused of having a right-wing bias. Not all of Fox's stars are avowed conservatives. For example, Bill O'Reilly was an avowed independent when he joined FNC. I say avowed because he was actually a registered Republican. He lied about it. He's a big liar. That's why he's one of the lying liars featured on the cover of this very book. He should be called Bill O'Reilly. We'll get to him in a minute. If any program in the Fox lineup represents the network's credo, fair and balanced, it's got to be what's been called the highest-rated show in television. It's not the highest-rated show in television, but Hannity often says it is. For those of you unfamiliar with the Hannity and Combs dynamic, it's a conservative versus liberal talking head show, a kind of combination between Crossfire and a Harlem Globetrotters game. Hannity spins around on the floor, dribbling behind his back, tossing alley-oops to Peggy Noonan and Bill Bennett. Combs, the lone Washington general, stumbles around confused until Ollie North hits him in the face with a bucket of confetti. So there you have it. The Roger Ailes starting five. Hume, Snow, O'Reilly, Hannity, and Combs. The Fox News Channel is currently the number one 24-hour news channel on television. It routinely beats CNN in the ratings. In just 7 years, Fox has grown from a mere twinkle in Rupert Murdoch's bulging eye into a veritable all-news Death Star in his media empire. And for that, I doff my hat to the Vader-like genius of one Roger Ailes, who has hit upon a winning formula, flag-waving, martial musical stings, the whoosh, frequent advertisements for the Abdominizer, repetition of the fair and balanced slogan, and right-wing propaganda. Chapter 13. Bill O'Reilly, Lying Splotchy Bully. Last time I saw Bill O'Reilly in person, he called me an idiot and screamed at me to shut up. He also said I was vicious with a capital V, which I suppose means that I'm especially vicious. This all happened on national television, if you can call C-SPAN national television. We were in Los Angeles at an annual publishing hootenanny called the Book Expo America. We were both there to promote our books. Bill was hawking his latest, Living with Herpes. Actually, the full title is Living with Herpes in George W. Bush's America, while I was promoting, with evident success, the book on tape that you are enjoying right now. We were on a panel with the wise, witty, and wonderful Molly Ivins, who was there to discuss her newest, Bushwhacked, Life in George W. Bush's America. I was concerned there might be fireworks between me and O'Reilly. A preliminary cover of my book had been blown up and prominently displayed at the convention center, and based upon what I know about Bill, it occurred to me that having to walk past a giant foam core book cover calling him a liar might light his notoriously short fuse. Also, as you may have noticed, the cover features an unflattering picture of O'Reilly looking splotchy and ill-tempered. Blown up 10 times, he looked 10 times splotchier. For the record, I had been hoping to get a better picture or at least have the cover artist remove the splotches. I first saw Bill when he charged into the green room and accused not me, but Lisa Johnson, my 109-pound publicist, of doctoring the cover photo to make him look bad. "This is what I look like," he said angrily, pointing at his nose. "I've never looked like that. You responsible for this?" he said, leaning his 6'4" frame toward her, jabbing his finger menacingly. "That's a doctored photo. This is what I look like." Again with the pointing, which seemed a little unnecessary since both Lisa and I recognized him from his many appearances on television. I tried to calm him down. "Bill, Lisa had nothing to do with the photo." "This is what I look like." I know. "I've never looked like that." Bill, this is a preliminary cover." I explained that, in fact, I had wanted to have the photo doctored to take out the splotches. I'd even wanted them to retouch my photo. I want them to take about 40 pounds off my ass. I thought that might lighten the mood. No sale. "I don't look like that. This is what I look like." Point. "Bill, we'd love to have a picture of you from the factory, something of you lying. Anything with your mouth open would work." Again, I was trying to lighten the mood, but I wasn't getting through. By then, the moderator of our panel, Pat Schroeder, was summoning us to the event, where 700 of America's best, our nation's booksellers, sat waiting for what promised to be a high-minded and civilized exchange of contrasting views between two men and a woman of letters. Molly went first and enchanted us all with her tart Texas wit. Next up, O'Reilly. After talking about his book for about 5 minutes, he began to talk about mine. Seeking to contrast his style with my own, he said, "I don't call people names. I don't call anybody a liar. I'm not doing that. I'm trying to elevate the discourse. I don't call people big fat idiots." Nobody missed the reference to my book, Rush Limbaugh's a Big Fat Idiot. Then it was my turn. Like the other panelists, I spent the first part of my allotted time describing my book in general terms. Then I got to O'Reilly. I felt a certain obligation to explain why a fellow panelist's face was on the cover of a book whose title included the words lies, lying, and liars. So I told a little story. A couple years ago, I was watching Bill O'Reilly on C-SPAN. He was being interviewed in front of an audience about his book, The No Spin Zone. The interviewer reached back a few years into O'Reilly's career. "Now, you were the host of Inside Edition. That was kind of a tabloid show." Now, I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have this one on tape. "Tabloid show?" O'Reilly was indignant. "We won 2 Peabodys. "Well, still, it was a tabloid show." "I beg your pardon, but the Peabody is only the most prestigious award in journalism," O'Reilly answered with great umbrage. The moderator said, "But you have to admit, Inside Edition was something of a tabloid show." "So you want us to give the Peabodys back?" O'Reilly smirked. "We won 2 Peabodys, the most prestigious award in journalism." Watching at home, I knew O'Reilly was right about one thing. The George Foster Peabody Award is the most prestigious award in broadcast journalism. But what on earth could Inside Edition have won a Peabody for? For its swimsuits, How Bear is Too Bear story, or maybe its three-part series on the father of Madonna's first baby, Carlos Leon? So I went to my Nexus and put in Peabody Award and Inside Edition, and I did get three hits. They were all Bill O'Reilly claiming that Inside Edition had won a Peabody, or two. If you listen to these O'Reilly Factor excerpts closely, you'll see an interesting progression. August 30th, 1999, O'Reilly. I anchored a program called Inside Edition, which has won a Peabody Award. May 8th, 2000, O'Reilly. Well, all I've got to say is that Inside Edition has won, I believe, two Peabody Awards, the highest journalism award in the country. May 19th, 2000, with guest Arthel Neville. Neville, you hosted Inside Edition, O'Reilly, correct? Neville, which is considered a tabloid show, O'Reilly. By whom? Neville. By many people. O'Reilly. Does that mean Neville and you, O'Reilly? We throw the Peabody Awards back? We won Peabody Awards. Next, I went to the Peabody website, which lists all their winners throughout the years. No Inside Edition. Still, to be thorough, I called the Peabody people and asked the woman on the other end of the line, did by any chance the show Inside Edition ever win a Peabody? She laughed. No, Inside Edition has never been the recipient of a Peabody Award. I decided to call Bill. He was nice enough to get right back to me. Yeah, what can I do for you? Well, first of all, Bill, congratulations on all your success. Thanks. What's up? Okay, I saw you the other night on C-SPAN. You said Inside Edition had won a couple of Peabodys. That's right. We won two. Well, you might want to check that out with the Peabody people because they don't think you did. There was a pause on the other end of the phone. Then, I'll call you back. About 10 minutes later, Bill was on the line. It was a poke. A poke, I asked. Yeah, just as prestigious as the Peabody. So, Bill, there are two most prestigious awards in journalism? Bill didn't appreciate the sarcasm. Al, it's a very prestigious award. Fine, I said, but, Bill, don't you think it's a little ironic that you got it wrong about a journalism award? Okay, Al, go after me if you want. And he hung up. And by the way, that poke, Inside Edition won it over a year after O'Reilly left the show. I thought Bill's reaction was odd. He hadn't said, oh my God, how embarrassing. I can't believe I've been saying that. Thank you so much, Al, for calling me. Now I won't humiliate myself by making that mistake again. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling me rather than taking it public. Instead, he said, go after me if you want. So I did. I called Lloyd Grove at the Washington Post Reliable Source column. Lloyd ran with it on March 1st, 2001, after checking Nexus. He also offered Bill the opportunity to respond and quoted him saying, Al Franken is on a jihad against me, so I got mixed up between a Peabody Award and a Polk Award, which is just as prestigious. Okay, so that was over. He got caught making a mistake, and he was kind of a jerk about it. Fine. Hang on. A couple of other papers picked up the Peabody story from the Post. Newsday, a Long Island newspaper, ran a March 8th column by Robert Reno titled, Some Factors About O'Reilly Aren't Factual. On March 13th, O'Reilly introduced that night's Personal Stories segment, Attack Journalism. This is personal to me because some writers are really violating every tenet of fairness in what they're saying in print about your humble servant. His guest was Michael Wolff, the terrific media columnist for New York Magazine. O'Reilly and Wolff began by discussing the definition of attack journalism. O'Reilly, it was clear, considered himself an expert on attack journalism, but not for the reason you might think. This is from March 13th, 2001, starts with O'Reilly. If you lie about someone, it goes right up on the Nexus, where everyone can read it. I'll give you an example. Guy says about me a couple weeks ago, O'Reilly said he won a Peabody Award. Never said it. You can't find a transcript where I said it. There is no one on earth you could bring in that would say I said it. Robert Reno in Newsday, a columnist, writes in his column, calls me a liar, all right? And it's totally fabricated. That's attack journalism. It's dishonest, it's disgusting, and it hurts reputations. It's also incorrect journalism if it's wrong. It is wrong. Okay, well, then the guy made a mistake. No, come on. He made a mistake that that lives forever in Nexus. And did he write a column the next day saying he made a mistake? Well, obviously he should. Usually I find if someone's made a mistake, if you ask them to correct it, they do correct it. No, not in this society anymore. So that was the story I told the 700 booksellers at the Book Expo luncheon. Bill O'Reilly mistook one poke that the show won after he left it for two Peabodys that, as he put it, we won. But then, not 2 weeks after conceding his error both to me and to the Washington Post, he attacked a journalist for accurately describing what he had done. I'd found four separate incidents where he had claimed to have won Peabody's, three of them in Nexus transcripts. O'Reilly bellowed, "Never said it. You can't find a transcript where I said it. It's totally fabricated. That's attack journalism. It's dishonest. It's disgusting. It hurts reputations." So O'Reilly had lied to cover up his mistake, and he'd called an honest reporter a liar. The entire crowd seemed to enjoy all the ironies of the story, with one exception, Bill O'Reilly, sitting 3 feet to my right, had become so angry he had developed another splotch. As I was telling the story, I could see him stewing, gripping his pen with seething fury. My wife, watching on television 3,000 miles away, thought that Bill was going to jam the pen through my eyeball and into my brain. But I was having fun, not because I enjoy attacking people gratuitously, but because O'Reilly is a bully and he deserved it. Everything I had said was true. On his show, O'Reilly cuts off anyone who disagrees with him. If they stand up for themselves, he shouts them down. But this wasn't his show. When I concluded my remarks, O'Reilly went nuts. First, he called me an idiot, fulfilling his earlier promise to elevate the discourse. Then, the king of the no-spin zone, where spinning is prohibited, started deliberately mischaracterizing what everyone in the room and watching at home had just heard me say. All he's got in 6.5 years is that I misspoke, that I labeled a Polk Award a Peabody. He writes it in his book, he tries to make me out to be a liar. Of course, that wasn't the problem. The problem was what he did once he was confronted with his misstatement. He went on the attack and lied. And here he was doing it again. "No, no, no," I tried to interject. "Hey, shut up! You had your 35 minutes. I had spoken for 20. Shut up!" Tempers flared. A moment later, O'Reilly was spinning like Ari Fleischer's dreidel. "This guy accused me of being a liar, ladies and gentlemen, on national television because I misspoke and labeled a Peabody a poke." Vintage O'Reilly. I had accused him of the ultimate sin. As he said on a C-SPAN call-in earlier that day, "Once you lie, you're out of the box. That's the no-spin zone." He said it to a Muslim caller who criticized the factor. Muslim caller. "There's a lot of anti-Islamic rhetoric on there. For instance, you know you compared the Quran to Mein Kampf." "No, I didn't. That's a total lie." Actually, it wasn't. The caller had been referring to a July 7, 2002 factor regarding a controversy at the University of North Carolina. The school had assigned its incoming freshman a book entitled Approaching the Quran, The Early Revelations. O'Reilly was outraged. "I don't know what this serves to take a look at our enemy's religion, see? I mean, I wouldn't give people a book during World War II on the Emperor is God in Japan, would you? I wouldn't read the book. And I'll tell you why. I wouldn't have read Mein Kampf either. If I were going to UNC in 1941 and you, professor, said, 'Read Mein Kampf,' I would have said, 'Hey, professor, with all due respect, shove it. I ain't reading it.'" The Muslim caller tried in vain to explain his question. "Can I just finish, sir? Can I finish my question?" "Whoa, hold it. Hold it," O'Reilly interrupted. "No, you can't finish. Because once you lie, you're out of the box. That's the no-spin zone. Get it? You can't say on national television, even if it's C-SPAN, you compared the Quran to Mein Kampf. That's a lie, all right? So you're out of the box." As distinct from Ann Coulter, whose lies are painstakingly crafted to serve her radical political agenda, Bill seems to lie for two reasons. One, to polish his own apple, Peabody's, and two, to attack anyone who's critical of him, Quran. Often the two are related. Take, for example, my favorite moment at the Book Expo luncheon. I questioned him about a claim he had made 3 minutes earlier about having started out with nothing. See, O'Reilly always likes to crow about his hard-scrabble childhood in working-class Levittown, Long Island. As he once told the New York Observer, "You don't come from any lower than I came from on an economic scale." Trouble is, an inside source, O'Reilly's mother, tells a different story. Mrs. O'Reilly proudly told the Washington Post that the family regularly took vacations in Florida and that little Billy attended private school, a private college, and that their home was in the affluent suburb of Westbury, not blue-collar Levittown. So, I asked Bill where he grew up. Was it Westbury or Levittown? Seemingly a hard question to spin. Backed into a corner, he replied with a crazy lie, saying that he had grown up in the Westbury section of Levittown. Now, there is no Westbury section of Levittown. They are two separate villages several miles apart. It was like saying he had grown up in Brooklyn, the Manhattan section of Brooklyn. O'Reilly's innumerable lies and distortions all feed a big lie, that he is a no-nonsense, bare-knuckled, working-class straight shooter who sticks it to the phonies and sticks up for the little guy. I ain't buying it. In reality, O'Reilly is as phony as his Peabody's. Under the guise of his angry everyman persona, he uses a shop-worn inventory of boorish tactics, bluster, bullying, and belittling, in order to advance a thinly disguised conservative agenda. It's not that O'Reilly is a Republican hack like Sean Hannity, whom we will meet in the next chapter. His position on issues is not doctrinaire movement conservative, and every once in a while I find myself in agreement with him, like when he says government should stay out of the bedroom or when I'm drunk. But his constant protest that he is an impartial observer and not an ideological conservative is just another lie. And it's another lie that he's had to lie about. From the 1996 launch of the O'Reilly Factor, part of Bill's credentials as a non-ideologue was that he was a registered independent. Lie. NPR's Mike Pesca refuted this in his January 2001 profile of O'Reilly for On the Media, reporting that O'Reilly had been a registered Republican since 1994. Calling the story a hatchet job, O'Reilly claimed, "I've never heard of NPR's Mike Pesca." In fact, Pesca had talked to O'Reilly for an hour and used portions of the tape conversation in the profile. Now, what about the party registration? Their accusation on my voting record is simply a lie, O'Reilly lied. I'm not surprised, since we've done a number of stories on NPR's left-leaning ways. Yes, O'Reilly admitted, he had been a registered Republican since 1994, but he had not been aware of it. It seems there had been an innocent mistake. "When I registered in Nassau to vote in 1994, there was no box for an independent. I left all the boxes empty. Somehow, I was assigned Republican status." In fact, Pesca showed me O'Reilly's registration form, and he had checked Republican, and there was a box marked "No Party Affiliation." One thing we do know for sure, Bill O'Reilly is a registered liocrat. O'Reilly is a right-wing blowhard of the schoolyard bully variety. He's not the only one, and he isn't even the worst of them. So when on his radio show the Monday following our book expo panel, he said that if we'd been in the Old West, I would have put a bullet right between his head, I couldn't resist a little grin. It was just so Bill. There is no shame in screwing up a statistic every now and then. People make mistakes. It's just that somewhere deep in O'Reilly's psyche, there's clearly a terror of being proved wrong. And when he's confronted with the mistake, the bully comes out and he bludgeons his guests with incorrect or just made-up facts and figures. On the February 5th, 2002 factor, O'Reilly told his guest, National Organization of Women President Kim Gandy, that 58% of single-mom homes are on welfare. Actually, only 14% of single moms are on welfare. When Gandy challenged him, O'Reilly bloviated, "You can't say no, Miss Gandy. That's the stat. You can't dismiss it. It's 58%. That's what it is in the federal government." On February 26, 2001, O'Reilly defended Jeb Bush's One Florida program to State Senator Kendrick Meek. "All right, look. In the university system in Florida right now, 37% of the 10 universities are black. 37%. Black enrollment that year was 18%. When Meek tried to correct him, O'Reilly cut Meek off with, I got the numbers, and they're dead on. On May 8, 2001, O'Reilly boasted that the United States gives far and away more tax money to foreign countries than anyone. Nobody else even comes close. Japan gives more, not per capita, more. When his guest, Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, pointed out that the United States gives a smaller fraction of its gross national product than any other developed country, O'Reilly bellowed, "That's not true." Of course it is. Bennis hung in there and said, "It's absolutely true on a per capita basis." Clearly, having no idea what he was talking about, O'Reilly flailed away. "Well, we have a 300 million population base here, and Sweden has 3 million, so that's skewed out. Sweden has about 9 million people." Now, like I said, there's no shame in occasionally messing up an obscure statistic like the population of a major industrialized nation. You probably didn't know it. I certainly didn't. But I would never insist that I did. Even when an obnoxiously persistent guest catches O'Reilly dead to rights, Bill still manages to sow seeds of doubt in the viewers' minds, as you can see from this 1999 program with popular corporate speaker Al Franken. Franken. In 1993, Clinton passed a budget deficit package with all Republicans voting against him. Clinton couldn't have passed it, Al, if all Republicans voted against him. Yes, he could. Well, every Republican voted against it in 93. Every one. Every single Republican. Is that you? I might stand corrected here. We'll look it up. You might. You do. It is. I do stand corrected? Yeah. Are you sure? Absolutely. Every Republican. Okay. All right. Well, we got the tape. Which, of course, they'll never rerun. These are only a few examples of few pearls dredged from the vast oyster bed feeding off the effluent flowing from the sewer of right-wing dishonesty. This book is not intended to be the definitive account of Bill O'Reilly's lies and obnoxious behavior. Inevitably, when this book comes out, Bill will employ one of his standard gambits, one which has a certain crude effectiveness. He will say, "Is that all you got, Al? After 6.5 years in the air, all you can find is my mistaking a poke I didn't win for two Peabodys that never existed and then falsely accused a journalist of lying about it, that I physically intimidated your book publicist, that I freaked out about the splotchy photo, that I compared the Koran to Mein Kampf and then lied about it, that I lied about where I grew up, that I lied about my party affiliation, that I gave phony numbers on welfare moms, black university enrollment in Florida and foreign aid, that I had no idea how Congress works, and I threatened to shoot you between the head. Is that all you got, Al? Is that all you got?" Well, no. Since you asked, there's also the fact that every once in a while you display such a depraved indifference to ordinary standards of decent behavior that it makes me wonder if I really was in danger there on the stage of Book Expo America. On February 4th, 2003, O'Reilly interviewed Jeremy Glick, whose father, a Port Authority worker, died in the World Trade Center attack. Glick had signed an advertisement opposing the war in Iraq, and O'Reilly invited him on the show to explain himself, which he did modestly and eloquently, until, that is, O'Reilly cut him off. "I don't want to debate world politics with you." "Well, why not? This is about world politics." "Because, number one, I don't care what you think." A little while later, O'Reilly told Glick to shut up. Shut up. When Glick tried to explain his point, O'Reilly told his engineer, "Cut his mic. I'm not going to dress you down anymore out of respect for your father." Once the microphones and cameras were off, Glick later told Harper's Magazine, O'Reilly sent him on his way with some words of fatherly advice. "Get out of my studio before I tear you to fucking pieces." Rap artist Ludacris never had the pleasure of being a guest on O'Reilly's show, but as Ludacris himself might say, this member of the hip-hopcracy was a victim of the man's hypocrisy. After PepsiCo featured Ludacris in an ad for their world-famous soft drink Pepsi, O'Reilly called on his viewers to start a boycott. "I'm calling for all responsible Americans to fight back and punish Pepsi for using a man who degrades women, who encourages substance abuse, and does all the things that hurt particularly the poor in our society. I'm calling for all Americans to say, hey, Pepsi, I'm not drinking your stuff. You want to hang around with Ludacris? You do that. I'm not hanging around with you." The clarion call brought an immediate result. As he said the next day on his show, because of pressure by Factor viewers, Pepsi-Cola late today capitulated. Ludacris has been fired. Now, I don't hold any brief for Ludacris. My son loves his stuff, as do many members of Team Franken. Also, my daughter dated him for a while, and I have to say, he seemed like a nice enough fella. It's just that, ignoring the obvious evidence of his name, O'Reilly insists on taking Ludacris's profane lyrics about prostitutes, street violence, and drug use at face value. According to my son Joe, what he enjoys about Ludacris is his gift for playful and irreverent hyperbole. That's how Joe put it in his 10th grade essay, Ludacris and the Mayor of Casterbridge, for which he received a B+. In his own artistic efforts, however, O'Reilly doesn't display the same deft touch, especially when writing about teen crack whores, pimps, vicious murders, and something that O'Reilly calls fellatio. I'm referring to his 1998 suspense thriller, Those Who Trespass, about a serial killer who will exact revenge on everyone who has sabotaged his rising TV career. Believe it or not, this is a real book written by the real Bill O'Reilly. Here is one of my favorite scenes in which the killer, Shannon Michaels, seduces Ashley Van Buren, a tabloid reporter. I should warn you, because of the turgid pedestrian prose and frank sexual nature of the following, young children and English majors might want to skip ahead. Ashley was now wearing only brief white panties. She had signaled her desire by removing her shirt and skirt and by leaning back on the couch. She closed her eyes, concentrating on nothing but Shannon's tongue and lips. He gently teased her by licking the areas around her most sensitive erogenous zone. Then he slipped her panties down her legs, and within seconds, his tongue was inside her, moving rapidly. In Ludacris's hit album, Word of Mouth, which my son tells me means word of mouth, there are depictions of 4 murders. In Those Who Trespass, there are 6 murders, one of which involves jamming a spoon through the roof of the victim's mouth and up into his brain stem. O'Reilly's book also depicts a 15-year-old crack whore performing this fellatio business on her pimp, Robo. Say, baby, put that pipe down and get my pipe up. While Ludacris, like O'Reilly, enjoys describing oral sex scenes, there are none on his album involving a teen crack whore. However, when it comes to the use of the words fuck and bitch, O'Reilly simply can't compete, managing a mere 51 variants of both words. Ludacris, on the other hand, achieves a commanding lead with 109 fucks and bitches, a better than 2-to-1 advantage. Perhaps in light of their similar taste for profanity, oral sex, and hoes, O'Reilly had second thoughts about his jihad against Ludacris, because 5 months later, O'Reilly denied that he'd ever called for a boycott. I simply said I wasn't going to drink Pepsi while that guy was on their payroll, he said. No boycott was ever mentioned by me. I think Bill O'Reilly unquestionably has talent, and not just a talent for lying. And I'll admit I sometimes find his program entertaining, especially when he runs circles around a particularly inept guest, like a man with a lazy eye and a speech impediment who's come on the Factor to demand rights for child molesters. That can be good sport. But at the end of the day, you have to ask yourself if it's worth the emotional capital necessary to try to change Bill O'Reilly. I believe it is. I dare to hope that Bill O'Reilly can be saved from himself. Because frankly, I don't think Bill O'Reilly likes Bill O'Reilly. Although he clearly has no love for me, I want him to know that I love him. And that when this book comes out, I would be delighted to reach out to Bill O'Reilly by coming on his program and giving him a chance to apologize for his lies and his lies about lies. I know it would be cathartic. When the last lie had been apologized for, the world would see a new Bill O'Reilly, fair, open-minded, genuinely impartial. Perhaps this new Bill O'Reilly's TV program would not be as successful as his old one, but the important thing is that if he doesn't calm the raging storm inside, the man may well be headed for a crack-up. Oh, one last thing about the splotchy photo. I'd been planning to have it de-splotched by the top guy in the field. But 3 days after our BEA encounter, Bill's publisher and agent called my publisher and said that he was threatening to sue if I didn't take his picture off the cover. Good move. So there you are, Bill, in all your splotchy glory. What was it anyway? Sun poisoning? A touch of the Irish flu? An allergic reaction to some shellfish you'd eaten at a Heritage Foundation event? Not that I'd believe you if you told me.